You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, September 26th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Destin Jenkins, historian and professor at Stanford University, on his book, The Bonds of Inequality, Debt and the Making of the American City. Meanwhile, the far right was victorious in Italy's elections yesterday, electing the coalition led by Giorgia Meloni, who ran on an anti-LGBTQ, anti-immigrant platform. This follows the rise of the far right in the halls of power in Sweden as well. Protests in Iran reached their 10th night after the death of a woman named Mahsa Amini, who died in custody of police for dressing improperly. Dozens have been killed in these protests, and hundreds have been arrested or injured. Back in the U.S., intelligence officials have resumed their probe into the classified documents that Trump kept at Mar-a-Lago after the appeals panel sided with the DOJ. New polling on the DeSantis Martha's Vineyard stunt has come out. Reuters found that only one-third of Americans support sending migrants to other states. Guess we're not as cruel as DeSantis thinks we are. A judge has reinstated Arizona's more draconian abortion ban, the one that passed in 1864, the one that has a 2 to 5 year prison sentence for helping a woman get an abortion, the one that has no exceptions for rape or incest. It's been 1 week since Hurricane Fiona hit Puerto Rico, and still, a little under half of the people on the island are without power. This comes as another hurricane is brewing in the Caribbean. Hurricane Ian is closing in on Cuba and Florida and is expected to be a Category 3 storm by tonight, so stay safe if you're in any of those areas. The autopsy report for Elijah McClain, who was killed by police when walking home in 2019, has been updated significantly. The new report now plainly states that McClain was killed by the lethal injection of ketamine given to him by authorities. And lastly, Elon Musk is scheduled to be deposed in his legal battle with Twitter after he backed out of that deal in July. That was one pricey PR exercise, Elon. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. I hope that you had a lovely weekend. I am in for Sam, who is celebrating the new year, and I'm here with Bradley and Matt to kick off the week. Hello, everybody. How was your weekend?
Good afternoon. It was pretty good. I was at a wedding in Vermont. It was very fun. I'm pretty hungover, but oh, no complaints.
Yeah, I was at a wedding on Saturday, and now I'm realizing that my hangovers for events like that last 48 hours at the very least. And I didn't drink pretty much all the week leading up to it, being like, all right, I'm going to be healthy, just have one nice night. And for somehow that makes it worse, I guess. So I guess the solution is to be drunk all the time, except not.
Ipso facto.
I will also be, yeah.
My solution is to start drinking at like 1 p.m. and then just be passed out by 7 p.m. and then you get an extra long
an early
time
night
to recover. Yeah,
there was like this is my high school friends. There was like an after party at a bar after, and I was like, no, and I still feel this badly. So I don't know how they do it, but you know, as the show goes along, I will gain power, much like Sam does. So, I headlined Italy and the insanely disturbing results from the elections yesterday there. I want to have a guest on later in the week to dive deeper into that. So to be clear, we're really trying to flesh out that story because it's a part of a significant rise of far-right fascists in Europe, and it's the furthest right government that has been in power since the Mussolini days, and this party actively longs for the Mussolini days. So we're going to do a deeper dive into that at a later date, later in this week. But for now, let's turn to the Sunday talk show circuit, because Chuck Todd had Representative Nancy Mace on his show and spoke to her about the impeachment of President Biden. So, I mean, for people who might feel like they misheard me, no. This all sparked really from comments made by Representative Adam Kinzinger, who's on his way out, and a so-called moderate Republican who essentially just said that the election was not won by Donald Trump, which is the reality of the situation. So he gets a bunch of press off of that. But he said that the Republican majority in Congress might try to impeach Biden every week if they're able to get their way. And he was talking about Marjorie Taylor Greene in particular. And so, like, this was, for some reason, despite the fact that it's obviously just another example of Republican insanity that has no merit to it, this was the topic of conversation on Sunday with Chuck Todd and Nancy Mace. And what's notable here is that Chuck Todd does not even ask what would he be impeached for, which I think would be the central question here, as I lay out that, like, there's really nothing to, there's no toehold here. I mean, Republicans had filed impeachment articles against Biden for withdrawing from Afghanistan, for example, or the eviction moratorium. These were the kind of stunts that they were engaging in. So it's obvious that there's no merit to this, and that should be the thrust of the conversation. But Chuck Todd just can't get enough of trying to get the headline about the impeachment in and of itself and the proceedings there, that he seemingly forgets to ask about, like, okay, on what grounds?
Republicans pitch, Kevin McCarthy put out his pitch for, they called it a commitment to America on this. And part of it in there was accountability, and it's kind of vague. But you've heard some of the details, and I know you've talked about the idea that there may be a special select committee. Do you expect an impeachment vote against President Biden if Republicans take over the House?
I believe there's a lot of pressure on Republicans to have that vote, to put that legislation forward and to have that vote. I think that is something that some folks are considering.
Wow.
Again, I'm someone who wants to, yeah, I want to follow the Constitution. It's really important. Oversight's important. But when I think of oversight of the federal government, I'm thinking about the waste, the fraud and abuse for the COVID-19 funding. You saw this administration just charge 44 people with a crime of stealing from the federal government $250 million. Those are the kinds of things that we need to make sure.
The thing that it's weird the way that she formulates that, because, like, we need to, and I'll cut back to us, but she says we need to look into, like, the waste, fraud, and abuse. And the thing that she cites is, like, an action against waste, fraud, and abuse, almost as if it's like we need to get in there and stop them prosecuting all of the people who donate to us that committed fraud through these programs. It just seems very strange. That's not impeachable there.
It's not. And it's just like a guess, you know, it all boils down to, like, policy disagreements that they have. But they're trying to, for Republicans, always the best defense is a good offense. And so since Trump was impeached twice, they have to kind of throw everything at the wall that they can with Biden here.
We have oversight on getting to the origins of COVID-19, better understanding how it happened, regardless of what side of the aisle you're on. We want to make sure that it doesn't happen again, at least in our lifetime. And we're keeping everyone safe in our country and around the world, too.
But if these impeach Biden votes come up, how are you going to vote?
Again, I'm going to read how that bill is filed, what's in it, what evidence there was. I didn't vote to impeach the former president of the United States because I felt like due process was stripped away. I will not vote for impeachment of any president if I feel that due process has been stripped away for anyone. And I typically vote constitutionally, regardless of who's in power. I want to do the right thing for the long term, because this isn't just about today, tomorrow, this year's election. This is about the future of democracy. This is about protecting our Constitution. Constitution. This is about protecting our freedoms and making sure my children and your children, everyone, their grandchildren too, grow up in the best country that it can be. And we have to work together and figure out the path forward, because the far fringes, the far right, far left, isn't going to cut it for the vast majority of Americans.
Okay, he's going to ask here.
I can't get over the first.
Pause for a sec. He's definitely going to ask, is that it? Oh, okay. I thought we had a little more, because I checked a little bit before. He doesn't ask what for. What the hell for? What the hell for?
Impeach him for the lab leak theory.
And yeah. It's just like, impeach him on the origins of COVID-19, because Dr. Fauci, who obviously was working with Biden when he was under the Trump administration as well, you got to keep that in mind, was working with the Chinese to create COVID-19. I mean, obviously, Chuck, but how are you going to vote, Nancy? How are you going to vote? Like that's the story here, I guess. It's just how many tallies of how is your guest going to vote on impeachment of the president, as opposed to like what would that impeachment entail?
And these sort of unserious fishing expeditions is all the Republican Party's been doing for our entire lives. Chuck Todd was born in 1972, which means he was in his mid-20s when the whole Bill Clinton impeachment scandal, which was just a long, like a fishing expedition among like the Whitewater and all these sorts of things that have been lost in memory now. Corruption politics, basically, like this is why you see how they're going after Lula, or they went after Lula, for instance, too, right? Like this focus on corruption politics. And this is, the Republican Party has been doing this, the Benghazi thing, we saw that too. This is just the way that party operates, and Chuck Todd is old enough to realize it, if we are. And, of course, he exists to allow the game to be continued to be played.
And to break news in his own way, right, which is just like Nancy Mace says that she will vote to impeach President Biden. That's the thrust of like what he wants to pin down. And
which is a strong propaganda message for the Republicans, because a lot of people don't necessarily see or won't even read the headline. But that's a headline, right?
Yeah. Like,
and Biden must have done something to justify it.
Stripping the context out of out of the way that Republicans operate only benefits and aids and abets fascism and far-right politics, because when you actually understand what they're after and what they're searching for, the value of what they're proposing, that's when you're actually able to make a determination between, I don't know, say impeaching a president for trying to overturn the results of an election and Biden maybe sitting too close to Dr. Fauci, the fascist, in a meeting or something like that.
Impeach Biden for Facebook suppressing the Hunter Biden laptop story.
Right. Impeach Biden for, instead of condemning his son in texts about his addiction, impeach him for saying, I love you, right?
Not continuing Title 42 or anything like that.
Not that. Well, I mean, come on. He's going to get unimpeached for that. That's how that works.
Yeah, an impeachment. Out of impeachment free card.
Bill V writes in Chuck Todd's defense, he did say wow in response to impeachment on Biden. You're right. There was a response there.
That was more of a wow, we got the news commodity
nice!
That we were angling for.
Literally everything that's wrong with the press
money.
Just kind of encapsulated in that.
Should have been a cha-ching sound.
That's on us with the soundboard. All right. Before we go to break and before we're joined by Dustin Jenkins, we have a few words from our sponsors. I mentioned that I was at a wedding over the weekend. You know what I screwed up doing? Not packing Liquid IV in my bag. Because Liquid IV contains 5 essential vitamins, B3, B5, B6, B12, and vitamin C. And it's very good at keeping you hydrated in a variety of different contexts. If you're on a long flight, especially if you don't want to take your mask off and you want to remain hydrated throughout that, it's really good. Really good on a hot day. Great if you're feeling a little hungover or as a benefit before you go to bed. That's honestly when it's worked out the best for me.
It's also
having
good
some Liquid IV.
If you're trying to drink a lot more water, but you kind of think water's boring, so you need to spice it up a little bit.
So Liquid IV, you get 3 times the electrolytes of traditional sports drinks, which have a bunch of gunk in it. Liquid IV is non-GMO and free from gluten, dairy, and soy. You can choose from 10 refreshing flavors, including Concord Grape, Lemon Lime, Pina Colada, and Tropical Punch. I want to try a Tropical Punch. That sounds good to me. The science of secular transport technology is what makes Liquid IV so effective. It's designed to enhance rapid absorption of water and other key ingredients into the bloodstream. Liquid IV is on a mission to change the world. For every purchase, they donate a serving to someone in need. The company has donated over 24 million servings globally. Hey, life's better when you're hydrated, so fuel your play with Liquid IV. For hydration, that's 2 times faster than water alone. Grab your Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco or get 15% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use the code MAJORITYREP at checkout. That's 15% off anything you order when you shop Better Hydration today using the promo code MAJORITYREP at liquidiv.com. It's a staple in my household. I use it all the time. I couldn't recommend it more highly. Now, if you're a small business owner, you know how important it is to be ready for the insane holiday season. And that's coming up sooner than we think. Luckily, Stamps.com has everything you need to make your life as a whole a lot easier. It's the 24/7 post office that you can access from anywhere. It's just right there on your computer. Say goodbye to lines, traffic, and hassle with Stamps.com. You can go there on your phone, go there on your computer. You don't have to just like time your day around going to the post office. It's right there. Get access to the USPS and UPS services you need to run your business right from your computer. Protect your margins with major discounts on USPS and UPS rates up to 86% off. That's a lot. Print postage wherever you do business. All you need is a computer and a printer. With Stamps.com's Switch and Save feature, you can easily compare carriers and rates, and if you're running an online store, Stamps.com works seamlessly with all the major shopping carts and marketplaces. Get ahead of the holiday chaos this year. Get started with Stamps.com today. Sign up with promo code MAJORITYREPORT, Majority Report, all one word, no spaces, for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code Majority Report. No spaces there. And lastly, did you know that there are currently over 2.4 million podcasts in the world, including the one that you're listening to right now? Well, I would like to think that this is one of the better ones, but yes. It takes a team of people to help bring these podcasts together. We got Bradley here.
Hi.
We got Matt, also part of the team. Say hello. You already did that. Never mind. Needless to say, hiring the right people for these roles is important. And luckily, we have hired the right people. And whether you're hiring for a podcast or for your growing business, there's only one place that makes it easy: ZipRecruiter. And now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter uses its powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. Additionally, ZipRecruiter has a complete suite of tools that make it easier to filter, review, and rate your candidates. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. So if you're a fan of this show and you want to try ZipRecruiter for free today to hire the right person, you need to remember our special URL, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Once again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/MAJORITY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Destin Jenkins. We are back, and we are joined now by Destin Jenkins, historian and professor at Stanford University, on his book, The Bonds of Inequality, Debt and the Making of the American City. Destin, thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here with you.
Of course. So your book really zeroes in on the mid-20th century cities in America and just how the construction of those cities essentially codified the inequality there. And your title says it plainly, the bonds of inequality, which I thought was, you know, well done, because your focus is very much on municipal financing and how that structure kind of shaped our cities today. How did you come to this topic?
Yeah, there are a few kind of milestones. The first is the 2008 financial crisis. I think for so many of us interested in the kind of progressive politics, for me at least, was thinking about finance, financial processes, financial institutions. And so 2008 is this kind of fallout. Of course, it dovetails eventually with the movement for Black Lives. So basically trying to think about the brick and mortar of inequality. And so from that point on, right within that context, the Detroit bankruptcy of 2013 was huge for me, because here we start to think about a predominantly Black city at that point in time, thinking about bankruptcy and who's going to take a haircut, who's going to receive, be paid in full on their various obligations, and what is the obligation of a city like Detroit to its long-term residents. And all of that stuff was wrapped up in municipal bond finance. I mean, since there's been a great deal of reporting and work done on, for instance, regressive fees and fines. So, you know, there's a bunch of us really interested in municipal finance, which oftentimes seems a kind of humdrum, mundane, boring area of study. But it's where so many ethical, political, and fiscal decisions are made, which materially affect the quality of water and that flow through our pipes, whether we have potholes in our streets, and all of that stuff is wrapped up with the ability of cities to issue a bond and the terms that come with it.
You mentioned Detroit there, and like as soon as I think of that crisis, I think of the concept of the emergency manager and how racialized that just like that phrase is, and what it means for who needs to have an outside manager to determine the state of their city. Why is that imposed on certain people and not on others? And I mean, and then you talk about clean water in your pipes. Like, you could just look in the Michigan area and find all of the racial infrastructure as contributing to that.
That's right. I mean, the emergency manager control board story is something I don't touch upon in the book, but it's absolutely relevant whether you think about New York City, or you could think about control board era in Washington, D.C., right? And you start to think about a Black mayor, Marion Barry, for instance, who goes through, of course, his own issues around substance abuse. But when we start to think about the early 90s, the kind of, you know, Republican Party is able to capture Congress and basically imposing, undermining home rule, which had been approved by voters in the 70s in D.C. But there is an expression of some would use the language of a kind of colonial structure, right? Undermining the democratic decision making of folks within D.C. through this outside force. In this case, it's Congress. But in Detroit, it's the appointment of an emergency manager. And really, it's all about the problem of democracy, right? The extent to which people have self-determination to decide on a bond issue, on a slate of elected officials, and when democracy exceeds itself, right? When people vote on in certain ways that's deemed unacceptable, whether it be in the case of a Republican Congress or members of the financial sector, who see more or less these decisions as running afoul of creditworthiness or the right kinds of decisions. There is this a set of mechanisms, whether it be in the form of the control board or otherwise, to undermine the vote, to undermine the decisions of an electorate. But you don't need a control board structure for this kind of undermining of democracy to take place. I mean, this is one of the things I talk about in the book. We talk about municipal finance as historically a technocratic sphere with people who have been appointed. And it's largely seen as, you know, when we start to think about the modernization of municipal finance in the 1930s, there's a conviction that we need to insulate matters of revenues and expenditures and debt from popular input. Some of that is well taken. It's a legacy of boss, you know, kind of boss rule, boss tweed, and the kind of patronage system that was so embedded in municipal finance. But modernization in this context in the 1930s means technocratic governance. And so you're going to see people with the expertise, the know-how, were going to be appointed to local screening committees, for instance, to decide what bonds even get placed before voters. And that's in the 1940s, right? So before that is to say the control board structure, which we see really proliferate post-1975 in the context of the fiscal crisis in New York. There are already ways to kind of insulate city finance from what's seen as the problem of too much democratic popular input.
Yeah, and I want to get into, you know, more of the nitty gritty of your book in a second, but just what's so central to these debates, as well as who is worthy of debt and who is not worthy of debt, and debt as a kind of disciplinary tool on certain populations that are running afoul of, you know, what these technocrats, I guess, like want, or what is fiscally responsible, but that brunt is felt by communities of color, almost always, more often than not. And, you know, it's also central even now when we're talking about student debt, right? As like a disciplinary tool for certain people. But these themes are, transcend, centuries, right? And is central to what you discuss.
That's right. I mean, this idea of worthiness is, it kind of really, it speaks to the kind of ethical dimensions of indebtedness. You mentioned it with student debt. And arguably, I mean, there's an ethical set of ethical considerations, certainly political considerations, across a variety of debts, student debt, housing indebtedness, municipal debt. And so that's one of the things I talk about in the book in the context of, you know, post-World War II American cities and, of course, the kind of the existential crisis really for American cities, which is suburbanization, right, especially of a white middle class that's receiving all kinds of subsidies being pulled to the suburbs. And cities, for instance, in San Francisco, really, which really is the focal point of the book, have to figure out, okay, given the fact that we're sort of landlocked, not a lot of land mass, how do we find ways to either keep folks from leaving to go to the suburbs, or how do we create the amenities that's going to be something of a kind of consumer playground for suburbanites when they come back to go to, say, a baseball game or come into the city to work. And so what you see is, you know, the worthiness piece is which kinds of projects should be elevated, which kinds of infrastructure projects should be elevated in pursuit of that kind of approach to economic growth and again, avoiding the horrors of urban decline, and which kinds of neighborhoods should receive infrastructural investment. Which neighborhoods, for instance, in Southeast San Francisco, and in this the Hunters Point neighborhood is not alone in this respect. We see the kind of black migration to the city, to that part of the city, and we see years and years of systematic, I wouldn't even call it divestment. It's just a lack of investment, essentially allocating bond proceeds and borrowed funds to other neighborhoods in the city. And so there's a worthiness piece as well, not just in terms of which projects are worthy of taking on debt, but which neighborhoods will receive that kind of investment. And so that's something I talk about in the book in terms of worthiness, which really, again, thinks about the pushes us to think about not just the fiscal, who services debt, what means, right, whether it be property taxes or sales taxes or some other revenue source, but who ultimately benefits and who's going to actually see the infrastructural improvements in their lives. And we see that as a further generator of inequality. And so that's the title, The Bonds of Inequality, thinking about the ways in which municipal bonds can exacerbate racial, wealth, spatial inequities in ways that have been previously underappreciated.
So, yeah, take us to the New Deal era and the post World War II era when this kind of municipal bond system begins to take hold in a lot of these cities looking to expand and in that period. How did that municipal bond system work and what like structures allowed for that municipal bonds to become dominant in these cities?
Yeah, it's a really great question. I mean, just to kind of take a step back, I mean, their cities or states and their political subdivisions have been issuing municipal bonds since at least the early 19th century. I mean, there's some discussion, I suppose, about when the kind of origin story begins with relying on debt to fund infrastructure. But the early 19th century is a good point. So we're thinking about states during that early 19th century period playing the dominant role. We see the kind of panic of 1837, the kind of financial collapse, and then local governments take on more and more of a role in funding infrastructure projects. Basically, in the late 19th century, it's largely in terms of privatized development. So this kind of upsets the notion of like when privatization begins. Great work from historian Robin Einhorn focuses in on Chicago, to basically thinking about cities like Chicago issuing debts, but for, you know, more or less the elite, the elites of the city. The early 20th century, we see that what's described and known as progressivism. So the sense that actually cities need to borrow on behalf of the public to combat the ills of urbanization and industrialization. Very important to note that from the beginning, or at least from that point, that progressivism or progressive debt finance takes the form of separate but equal. Right. So we're talking about segregation that's built into that early 20th century story of the bond market. So this is why in the book I use the word rekindles. Right. So thinking about the New Deal in the context of the Great Depression, kind of fallout of various of defaults across various types of debts, the property tax delinquency in cities, basically cities, you know, struggling as in the residents in cities struggling. And so it's in this cauldron of trying to figure out, well, how do we get people back to work through infrastructure projects? And so the New Deal becomes this moment, specifically the Banking Act of 1933, which is, you know, really important for me as rekindling this older reliance on debt finance when it arguably didn't have to be that way. I mean, you could think about socialist Upton Sinclair. He's thinking about in poverty in California, he has this sense of this vision of how he ends poverty in California if he were to be governor. And so he proposes this idea of a California authority for money, which would through an authority structure issued $300 million in bonds. It would be staffed by political appointees, including Wall Street defectors. So there's still this need to understand, like, how do we actually govern fiscally, and how do we get people back to work in that way? And for him, he's like, we're trying to sell bonds, quote, directly to the people to obviate commissions to any bankers. So there is, in the 1930s, something of an alternative, even though it still relies, of course, on financial markets to mobilize capital. But what happens instead with the Banking Act of 1933 is we see the separation of commercial and investment banks, but it's still going to allow both the ability to underwrite certain obligations of states and municipalities. And so that, along with other ways of kind of basically placing a federal stamp of approval on the private rating system, despite the dismal failures of a Moody's and these credit rating agencies, is going to revive and allow these folks to have a seat at the table, so to speak, and eventually basically bite the hand that fed them by the time we get to the 1970s and decrying the kind of welfare state syndrome, which was so key to reviving these institutions some 40 years prior.
So in essence, what this does is it financializes these cities, and it creates a dependence on banks and wealthy individuals who are going to be determining, probably in the end, and we'll get there, the future of these projects, because it's their investment, as opposed to, you know, granting money for these kinds of projects, which we've mentioned this on the show before, that the New Deal did not go challenge capitalism enough, frankly, and this seems to be a prime example of that, which It also seems to rely on the assumption that these markets can be apolitical organisms, as opposed to heavily influenced by, you know, politics and racism and all of the things that you discuss.
Oh, I mean, you said it. You just said it. I mean, that's a really excellent synopsis. So thank you for that. I mean, I guess the let me just sort of elaborate on a few things. The first is you got the word dependence. And that's really what the book is trying. It begins with that question of why it is that American cities are dependent on a set of unelected actors who I describe in the book as a fraternity, who really depend on vibes, even as they sort of elevate a kind of set of technocratic discourse of debt ratios and so forth. But a kind of sociality that is deeply patriarchal, deeply elitist and racist, to build trust in order to form syndicates, which are going to be key to buying and underwriting various bond issues across the country. So it's trying to think about that story and of dependence, because it doesn't have to necessarily be that way. I remember reading an article kind of published in the context of the New York City fiscal crisis that talked about how state-controlled banks in Italy were helping debt-plagued municipalities. It was a different kind of revenue-sharing formula in West Germany, and it was all kind of more or less highlighting what one could say a kind of American exceptionalism of relying on municipal bond issues. And so it's trying to see dependence on the private sector or the bond market in particular as not natural, not inevitable, and trying to unearth and historicize that story in order to think about alternatives to dependence. You mentioned grants as direct grants without, you know, the kind of strings attached that might come with borrowing and lending through the bond market. I mean, I think it's important to note for just folks tuning in that, like, federal financial power in the form of grants is not necessarily a panacea either or a silver bullet for inequity. I mean, especially when you think about the structures of American federalism, we could think about the channels through which federal funds would flow potentially and the kind of racist elites and various elites who might then direct federal funds into subsidizing certain folks who have political power and clout. And so it's important to know that even as federal financial power in the form of grants might obviate some of those other inequities produced through the bond market, it's not an end all be all. It's not a silver bullet. But it is worth thinking about other ways of mobilizing capital, especially for infrastructure, because it's very different from, I think, a real estate market, right? I mean, you can think about leveraging funds from a community. Some folks have tried to more or less decommodify or pull definancialize pension funds to then purchase land and then build housing, for instance. But how does one mobilize enough capital to not just build a sewage system, for instance, but to also maintain it over? So it's a different kind of temporality. And so the advantage of financial markets is the ability to mobilize capital very quickly and without the kind of bottlenecks that come within our American federalists. And bottlenecks is a euphemism, but that come with our federalist structure. So anyway, that's just but you nicely put it right. I mean, in terms of financialization of our cities, the kind of dependence on this a set of actors and you know, questioning why that came to be, and is this the only way?
So those actors then, let's talk about, you know, how they begin to wield their influence, right? You mentioned how Glass-Steagall essentially allowed for these banks, these commercial banks, to underwrite municipal bonds. And then this kind of, and the banks were obviously hurting during and after the Depression. So this creates a new opportunity for them to make some money here. And we move into the 40s, and these, like, tax exempt investments start to gain some steam here. How does this begin to explode?
Yeah. So let me put some flesh on the bones there, right? So we can think about, in 1946, for instance, the municipal bond market had seen 3,300 new issues of long-term debt. That's totaling about $1 billion. By 1965, state and local governments nearly doubled the number of new issues, raising some $11 billion. So it is this post-World War II, and it's kind of like it's the lure following World War II of low interest rate. So the cost to borrow in the spring of 1946 for highly rated, which we can talk about for sure, highly rated cities is going to be about 1%. And so you have all of these borrowers trying to, or local governments trying to respond to a number of pressures. One being infrastructural deterioration due to the wartime migrations to cities. Improving infrastructure built some 30, 40 years prior. So it's all of these pressures and kind of responding to a low interest rate environment to try to improve the infrastructure of American cities. That explains that kind of that explosion. And as you said, there's a somewhat of a compact here, right, where you have cities that are going to borrow from wealthy individuals and institutional, select institutional investors. And in return for lending funds to local governments, they're going to get tax exempt interest income. And so that's a point that is really important in the book. So we're thinking about kind of mid 20th century versions of today's offshore tax havens, where it's not illegal. It's not really even a loophole. It's a cornerstone of a massive market that promises tax exempt interest income. And you have people like FDR in the late 30s, early 40s, who says that basically tax exemption cannot exist alongside a progressive income tax system. It's totally at odds. And so there's that compact that comes with it's kind of the political story, I suppose, of that economic story of change over time between 46 and 1965. So then we start to think a little bit about power and influence. And I'll just pull out two examples. The first is what I mentioned. It's the bond screening committees in San Francisco. And again, within this kind of technocratic milieu, reliance on those with the know-how, and particularly those who are well connected, right? We see folks who, for instance, a gentleman who's key in the book by the name of Alan K. Brown, he's a banker with Bank of America, who also was appointed to this bond screening committee. And the bond screening committee doesn't have sort of veto power, at least in the legislative statutory sense, but wields influence in terms of shaping the dollar amount of a bond issue, elevating an infrastructure project for, say, that's best for economic growth over and above, say, infrastructural investments for, say, welfare, supporting welfare expenditures. And so the influence there, it's not like a one-to-one power relation per se, but the reliance on folks who are market makers to then shape issues long before voters ever see it is one way in which influences these actors and folks within the financial sector in particular exercise influence. And really, we're thinking about, like, okay, the elevation of members of a financial elite over above the everyday citizenry who ultimately has to service the debt. And that's the argument in the 1970s, the kind of progressive left San Francisco Bay Guardian looks at the bond screening committee and says, but these guys don't even live in San Francisco. They live in like Walnut Creek, you know? And so they're appointed to this committee and then shaping which kinds of projects the city ultimately takes on. And so questioning that kind of power form of influence. And the second example I'll give just in terms of influence is power really goes back or it boils down to narratives. The kinds of narratives being told about the problem of cities in the 1960s. So we're thinking about the urban uprisings. I've got a colleague, Elizabeth Hinton, who's written about the urban riots, as they were typically known as urban rebellions, whether it be in Watts or San Francisco or Newark or Detroit, and the sense that these were moments where or signified that cities were losing their way, unable to govern. And so we start to see the deployment of a narrative that cities are succumbing to minority interests and labor in elevating that to explain bloated expenditures and a kind of ineffective governance. an elevation of and really blaming minorities who more or less were protesting the systematic divestment of their communities and making demands on the state. That gets read as a problem. And so the elevation of that narrative that this is the problem of cities, it's due to these particular interest groups without, and this is coming from folks who would never describe themselves as an interest group, but see minorities and labor as a special interest group distorting the future of the city. But they wanted their cake and they had their cake in 82. So they would see the city is losing its way, but they speculated, and this is what I describe in the book, in riot futures. So in the spring of 66, 67, or in the context of these urban uprisings before the long, hot summers, which was supposedly when, and often was when stuff would hit the fan, you had folks saying, well, you could still invest and collect tax-exempt interest income in an escalating borrowing context, but not tie up your capital in long-term debt. Instead, purchase short-term notes. Invest in the city for 6 to 9 months, see a return of your principal, collect tax-exempt interest along the way, and then redirect that capital elsewhere. And so a way of kind of obviating a long-term obligation to the city and then pushing cities, which then increasingly start to prioritize short-term horizons, revenue targets, and so forth over a long-term investment in its citizens. So that's a long way of saying that the influence there is in terms of the narratives told about who or what is the problem and what should be the solution to the problem, which by the time we get to the 70s could be read as shock therapy. The sense that the credit window should be shut. And if cities run afoul, too bad. And then pushing cities are increasingly recommending that cities embrace austerity, regressive user fees and charges and the kinds of stuff that really define our day-to-day experience of urban life.
I mean, and this is more in part one of your answer, a response to that. But when you talk about these like tax havens for the wealthy, this becoming some of their pet projects, you see how durable this concept is in like the notion of opportunity zones, which was a Trump era, I believe, policy, or at least they exploded under him, which basically is a very similar version of this in the sense that liberals, technocrats, wealthy people saying like, this is what this urban space should look like, and I'm going to invest here. Return on my investment. The tax code creates fertile ground for me to make this kind of investment. And they're often vehicles of displacement and of segregation because of just like the nature of the way that the tax code is written. And like, you know, I was fascinated to read about how, as you describe in San Francisco, they're trying to maintain a certain level of profit amid the suburbanization of the 1950s. And like, then it San Francisco becomes this vision of what the investors believe that the city should look like, which is really just like, entertainment, leisure, and corporate office spaces. Talk about that transformation, how quick that was and how that affected San Francisco.
Yeah, a lot there. Let me work backwards. So this is why I think San Francisco is a really useful example. In some ways, folks have been a bit surprised, though I think they ultimately are convinced. But San Francisco is often seen as like the city that got it right in some sense, right? It's kind of liberal culture, right? It's kind of sense of tolerance. I'm not saying I believe it, but this is something, in fact, I was confronted with so often that people and told me not to write about San Francisco when I was.
I mean, sorry to interrupt you, but it's like highest cost of living right now in the country and also just like massive, the epitome of, we're here from Brooklyn and like they've overtaken Brooklyn in terms of like being an avatar for gentrification in the city, I would say. But
And that's interesting as well, because that is true. And it's often juxtaposed to, you know, the glory days of the 60s and 70s and early 80s, right? Like seeing San Francisco as San Francisco is a problem, but it's a more recent phenomenon and it's due to techies. But one of the things I show in the book is urban renewal what James Baldwin and so many others have since described as Negro removal, was a form of gentrification that began in the 50s and picks up in the 1960s. And so, but there's this story about San Francisco as the exception, and it's the exception, of course. The exception only makes sense when you compare it to a Detroit, to other Rust Belt cities, and even the kind of Sunbelt cities that was dominated increasingly by kind of conservative populists that then would roll back the welfare state. So all that is to say that San Francisco was oftentimes I was told not to work on the city of San Francisco. But I will say, and this, the reason why I think San Francisco is in some sense, the exception approves the rule, the exception in the sense that it doesn't experience deindustrialization in the ways that a Cleveland, a Detroit, a Flint. I mean, it doesn't experience the consequences or fallout of reliance on mass production along Fordist lines that really helps to explain the success and failures, the decline of a Detroit. Instead, San Francisco sort of begins this kind of industrial dislocation in the early 20th century and ties itself to the fire sector. I mean, you guys in New York. So, you know, we're thinking about finance, insurance, and real estate, and trying to use land for financial services. And so in that sense, it's kind of ahead of the curve, right? In the sense of like anchoring its local economic growth to the sector that is supposedly going to allow the city to be insulated from deindustrialization. But what we see in the book is essentially, and this is where the bond screening committee, this is where the stuff we talked about, like which projects are worthy of investment. We see more or less the city be used for erecting, elaborating a consumer playground, again, for suburbanites who want to come check out the San Francisco Giants, or the elevation of the Bay Area Rapid Transit, which is the kind of three countywide mass transportation system, bringing suburbanites to the city to come to work and to consume and then to take them back home, to say nothing of the neighborhoods that's destroyed in Oakland in order to build BART, the neighborhoods in Southeast San Francisco that are bypassed completely, largely, I would say, because there's so many Black folks who live there. Really, we see the kind of post-World War II borrowing, but borrowing on behalf of a certain vision of economic growth predicated on satisfying the needs of a white-collar professional class. And here's another thing I sort of talk about in the book. It's kind of like intra-class relations among white folks, because you have wealthy white individuals who are largely going to be the individuals lending to cities, collecting tax-exempt interest income. So there's the form of wealth inequality in that way. And then you have segregated building trades, white workers who's going to build the infrastructure on which consumption rests. And then, of course, the infrastructure that's going to allow for consumption for a white middle class. So there you have white working class, white middle class, and a white upper class is really going to benefit from this post-World War II debt combat until the edges start to fray in the late 60s for various reasons. Again, whether it be from the banker standpoint, because cities are succumbing to minorities and labor unions, the macroeconomic context of the rising cost to borrow. And so the late 60s is really when it's kind of the crescendo for the book, and I think for cities and local government borrowers more generally. And it's from that point in time, you have more and more folks. And here's, I guess, the political story. More and more folks, it's described as the minority revolution. Basically, you could think about the civil rights revolution saying, look, we've been servicing debt for 15, 20 years. We've gotten very little in return. We haven't gotten any political positions. We haven't been appointed to, say, public utilities commissions. We've seen our neighborhoods destroyed through the issuance of various debts. And enough is enough. And the exercise of political power, for instance, at the ballot box by saying, we're not going to vote for these issues. In fact, we're going to say, vote no on these city spending priorities. And so there's the sense of the downstream effects of a 20-year debt compact, where folks have greater awareness and reject what the city is selling, so to speak. And then you have the kind of the sense among folks within the financial sector that cities have lost their way, a kind of revolting image of the city as people are launching their own revolt against the city's spending priorities.
So then, so that revolt happens, and at the same time, we begin to see a takeover of austerity politics, particularly affecting, in the context of your book, these communities that are bearing the brunt of the debt in these cities. Just talk about that transition to austerity politics and that kind of taking over in both the discourse and in application for these communities.
Yeah, austerity politics is a great way to describe it. I mean, so here's where the book is at once a national story, but there are going to be some regional particularities. So we have a rising cost of borrow, rising inflationary context in the 1970s that's going to collide with arguably be the support, you know, the kind of economic base, if you will, of the Prop 13 and the tax revolt in the late 70s. So there's a sense that after 78, that the property tax, which is kind of seen as the sort of primary means by which debt is serviced, and really is the sort of anchor of general obligation bonds, which relies on largely on property taxes, that basically that reliance is finished. I mean, one person, a banker, calls the general obligation bond debt as a dodo bird, right? The sense that now at this point, cities are going to have to rely on other revenue sources, other kinds of debt instruments to fund infrastructure. And so so that's the kind of California context of a property tax revolt, which is then going to spur the turn towards user charges, user fees, higher charges and rates to go to, say, the Oakland Zoo, higher bus fares, the end of subsidizing transportation. Although, again, it's not a complete end because subsidization of transportation had always been unequal. But you start to see more or less a political economy, a local political economy predicated on these kinds of regressive revenue sources. And that ties into the kinds of debts the cities can issue and increasingly do issue. And so the austerity politics is that kind of defines our kind of post 75, 76 era. You can start to think as well about austerity, not just in terms of cuts, not just in terms of aggressive revenue generation, but also in terms of reliance on, say, contracting out, really privatization. So you see in 78 in Los Angeles County and the city of LA propositions, A&P, which is going to allow for contractors more or less to increasingly play the role of government actors in performing various services. So it's in this context, in other words, of austerity. And that context is very much rooted in not so much neoliberalization or financialization, but in the politics of municipal indebtedness and the changing borrowing conditions and terms and the cost of borrow that's going to accelerate this turn towards austerity cuts and regressive revenue solutions. And more broadly, the kind of emaciation of a public sector.
And you know, I have to let you go shortly, but I appreciated so much about all of the context that you bring to this topic is that I feel like redlining, that's only a part of the way that we understand how infrastructure is segregating. This whole the concept of debt and who bears the burden and who gets their debt alleviated and who has to constantly be in a cycle of paying this back because the narrative is financial irresponsibility in black neighborhoods. Like that is so as central as redlining is.
Yeah, I think that's right. Housing, and I have had conversations with folks, you know, the redlining stuff is so important. People doing such excellent work on redlining. One of the things I try to talk about in the book to kind of build on that excellent work is the monetization of redlining. There's a sense, redline areas, there's a sense that areas that neighborhoods that have been redlined essentially worked as kind of repellents of capital, so that instead of institutional capital, you have through mortgage finance, you have petty loan sharks and other forms of extraction, because redlining so thoroughly repelled capital in institutional investment. But one of the things I show in the book is how public housing projects were often located in redline areas. And public housing was the projects, especially built after 1949, was funded and financed through the bond market. So you have institutional investors who hold bonds tied to public housing projects. That's not a repellent at all. In fact, that's the profitability of redlining through these institutional channels and for these institutional actors. So there definitely is this overlap and connection between the redlining housing story and the quality of infrastructure, a story to be told about the overlap of housing and the bond market. They work in tandem, but what the book tries to do, and what I've since really dedicated my time, including being on your platform, is trying to get people to think about two things, really. Infrastructure and bonds is not just boring, dry matters, but actually arenas of political struggle. That's number one. And yet trying to ask the question of, if the bond market is such a powerful generator of inequality, and I argue that it is it not also still the best way, at least the most expedient, efficient way of raising capital in the context of ecological destruction and climate breakdown? If you start to think about other bottlenecks and limits on mobilizing funds, again, going back to federal grants, as we talked about, right, within our sort of minoritarian structure of Congress, given the composition of the Supreme Court, even if you had this vision of direct grants without onerous strings attached to cities, there's the question of whether that would ever get off the ground, or would it be nullified? And so, given all of the inequalities that come with the bond market, is it possible to use debt along more progressive lines and to leverage the bond market to supply vital infrastructure to communities who don't just need infrastructure today, but needed it a long time ago? I'm thinking about Puerto Rico. I'm thinking about Jackson, Mississippi. And so these are the two questions I want folks to walk away with when they think about infrastructure and debt finance, and also to ponder some of the dilemmas before us as we try to do something about inequality, even if it might deepen other inequitable structures and relations.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, like a central struggle sometimes, being on the left and talking about like ideal systems that would be better, while also exploiting the systems that we currently use for short-term gains. It's like, when sometimes we'll have viewers write in saying, I don't want to vote for the Democrats ever again because of this. But well, mm-hmm. we kind of also have to, because that's the system that's in front of us, and we have to use that for short-term gains. But with that said, I really appreciate your time today. Destin Jenkins, historian and professor at Stanford University. The book is Bonds, The Bonds of Inequality, Debt and the Making of the American City. Destin, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks, with that, we are going to wrap up the free part of this program. We're going to be taking your calls in the fun half, doing some clips, reading your IMs, 646-257-3920. But first, Matt, what is happening this week on Left Reckoning?
Yeah, tomorrow night we got both Darn and Noor in the public show and Cale Brooks in the post game. So patreon.com/Left Reckoning. And I said that because I'm blanking on what we released. Chip Gibbons on Julian Assange and revelations about how the CIA spied on Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy through a security firm. Very interesting stuff from Chip Gibbons, who is, I think, the best on, or one of the best on, the sort of civil liberties government watching beat. Chip is a very smart guy, and also doesn't go out of his way to like launder say a fascist leader of Italy on his free time.
That's good.
Check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
good to hear that. Right, I'm wondering who that was a shot at, like
maybe we'll talk John Greenwald and the new Italian girl boss.
Jesus. On ESPN today, we will have a new episode. We'll probably talk about how Brett Favre should be
Monday,
in prison.
ESPN.
Yeah.
That stuff is getting crazy.
Yeah, Brett Favre gives us new content on ESPN every week, as does the NFL, which I would say this was one of not a fun week three in particular, although it was fun for Bradley, who went 3-0 in his picks and now has basically caught up to me in this little competition that we have
going
on.
The house always wins.
You are the house.
I'm the house.
So we'll also be talking about Russell Wilson's poor performance so far, despite getting a $250 million contract, what that means for the Broncos organization, which I would not have any confidence in if I were a Broncos fan.
It means you paid for past performance, which you should not do in sports.
Seahawks look like they have won that trade. We will also talk a little bit about Brady's not-so-great performance against the Green Bay Packers defense, among a bunch of other things, and the fact that the Las Vegas Raiders are the only 0-3 team in the NFL this year. Is Josh McDaniels living up to the hype as an offensive coordinator, and more as the head coach of the Raiders? We'll be talking about that. So check that out, 4 p.m. here on the Majority Report channel, live, and then you can also listen to us in podcast form. Please rate us 5 stars, ESPN, and subscribe to the channel, ESPN Show. That is on how you can find us on YouTube. All right. We will be seeing you in the fun half, 646-257-3920. Bye-bye. See you there.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority
Report. Unpacked. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Unpacked. Matt.
Drew.
Unpacked.
What is up, everyone?
Unpacked.
Nomi Keen.
You did it.
Unpacked.
Let's go, Brandon.
Unpacked. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7A?
Yes.
Me? Is this?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go for that
way. Libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge Matt.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3551. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
We call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.